But it should be ingrained in the person to have compassion, not only compassion for his fellow man, not only mercy, but also reverence. Now we are come again to our writer, secular writer, Tennyson. He wrote a short story, which was translated almost in all European languages, and it's well known. The story is called Bunch of Flies, as you heard of this story. Bunch of Schweig is, to say Bunch is a name, and Schweig means the silent bunch, but it means more than silent bunch. And whoever, I'll tell you frankly, you don't have to believe in a small Jewish town in Schweinger or Holland in order to appreciate Bunch of Schweig. In America, I haven't seen that. Because in America, such a Bunch of Schweig would be classified by the agency as a retarded child and put away. There's no Bunch of Schweig, I mean, walking the streets of the town. Bunch of Schweig usually used to go up when the Ricardo child was born. And they couldn't attend cheder, I mean, or the school. I mean, if you attended, his instructions were completely useless and worthless. So he grew up to be the moron of the town. What we call in Yiddish, a shtot mitzvah. Sometimes we were very noisy, sometimes we were quiet, mute. I knew such a man, we used to call him as a child, I remember. I was six years old, in a small town in Russia, he used to call him Alta Dana, Alta the name, Alta the Moron. So what did the Alta do? Alta, for instance, the Moron, inherited a few hundred dollars from his father, or someone borrowed the money from him. So he was supposed to receive interest, of course. So the interest he used to receive is that he used to draw water and chop wood for the man who borrowed his money. This was an institution in the small towns in Lithuania. This is Bunch of Schweig. Otherwise, it's hard to appreciate the story. So, of course, if there is a person who could not contribute anything to society, the lowest station, this is the type of Bunch of Schweig, or as I call it, Alta the moron of the town moron. So Peretz writes, the death of Bunch of Schweig made no impression. No one knew or cared to know. I had to translate it because I gave away the book I had before. It is in a letter of French, you'll find the translation, but this I did because I didn't have the book. No one knew or cared to know who Bunchy was, how he lived, and what was the cause of his death. Did he suffer a heart attack? Did his strength give out? Or did his spine collapse under the heavy load he was wont to carry? I mean, not being paid for them, of course. For all we know, he might have died of hunger. This is the most probable thing. Bunch lived quietly and died quietly. He passed through our world like a shadow. At the circumcision of Bunch, the voice of Bunch, there was no clatter of wine glass. No wine nor whiskey was drunk. No address was delivered at his family, and no brilliant speeches were made. His life was gray and undistinguishable from the lives of millions of men around him, as one particle of sin is not different, is not distinguishable from the millions of particles of sin at the beach. And no one noticed when the wind carried a particle of sand across the sea. The beach remains the same. Bunche left no footprint in the mud. He where lived. And after his death, the wind carried the small marker of his grave away. The wife of the gravedigger found it in some distant place away, picked it up, built with it a fire on which she cooked potatoes. 3 days later, his death and not even his grave digger. His death was forgotten and not even his grave digger knew where he died. If there is a muscle description, anonymity, about anonymity which the Halacha calls, has given. But there is, he was born quietly, he lived in silence, he died mutely, and he was buried noiselessly. This is all right. Now comes, let me say, the finale. Got the long story. In heaven it was quite different. In heaven it was quite different. There his death made a profound impression. The big shofar of Messiah sounded aloud and announced throughout the seven heavens von der Schweige died. And he's coming into heaven. The most prominent among the angels whispered to each other until she was summoned before the court of the Most High. The great bunch is coming. The paradise was in uproar. Such joy, such an excitement, it is no mean matter. Bunch of Schweizer. He expressed his sentiment. What I try to express unsuccessfully in believing almost in an hour. That's all. This is usual. And the end of the story tells how little he was that when he came before the heavenly tribunal and they told him all the treasure, every type of belief, spiritual beatitude, is his, all he asked. A warm wall with butter every day. It means his imagination was so limited. That's all. And still he was great in his beauty, because he had something, his tenderness, his something. The inner world is not measured by his foolish behavior. Not even on earth, by his foolish behavior on earth. Yes, sir.
I don't think our problem is so much the attitude of us for the simple. I think those people more likely bring out the best in us. Better in us. The attitude is for the arrogant, the haughty, the indecent. What, then, would you cover that later?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But Dr. Eisenberg, aren't we all arrogant?
Haughty? Of course. But no, haughty? I don't think so. I don't think quite.
I am. As far as I'm concerned, I am. I can speak all that myself. But I am at many times arrogant.
You're probably tempering your
irony
with a lot of
self-pity. Certainly. I'll give you an example. I deliver my lecture. You mean who does not do any soul searching? I mean, all right, yes. Yes, this is unmitigated arrogance. But I am also arrogant, but many times. And I promised myself I would never do that again. And I sleep and fall.
Well, now, Dr. We have given King David and Jacob and other people a place in our...
Certainly, in our pantheon, yes.
Because these are the people who struggle with themselves. Correct. And wasn't that the idea?
Yes, Dr. Eisenberg, I'll talk to the problem one struggling with himself with. I'll take up this problem. You are right. A man cannot be born perfect. He's an eternal struggle with himself. No, this is Judaism.
This concept of the concern for the lowly and the...
Yes, of course, you take the gospel. The heaven, the gates of heaven, up and away for the meek.
Blessed
are the meek. Yes. But first of all, what the gospel said particularly in this regard is what's taken from Judaism. No theologian now, I want you to understand, no theologian now, in his, so to say, in his esteemed theologian, in his ordinary sense of a man who does not, will say that these chapters of the gospel were invented by Christ. They were taken from the Jewish ethic. Number one. Number two is something else is important. Important is, it's a chapter of the gospel. To us, it wasn't only a chapter of the gospel. It was to some extent practice. You know, there is in Shalom Aleichem a story, and the name of the story is called Nir is good, Yir ben Ayotem. I feel well or good, I feel good because I am an orphan. It means he's somehow immune to anything. This is very typical. It's very typical of the Jewish mentality. It's very typical of the Jewish mentality. You see, literature describes. We were very careful about it. I mean, our rabbis, I can tell you that. Please don't classify me because I am already half Americanized and a certain default of American revenue. I discovered and also, I mean, seem to assimilate it. But I know I come from a rabbinical house. My grandfather, forefathers were rabbis for many generations. The democratic approach, this being accessible to everybody, this lack of arrogance, this sense of humility. It's too bad that our people don't know about it. It has not been perpetuated through literature. Sometimes you singled out the Goy, and the Goy was also a humble person, but he was a spiritual aristocrat, basically. What did the average rabbi, say the Hasidic rabbis, what was great about Hasidism? His democratic approach, anybody with a torn suit, I mean, any moron. Actually, Hasidism, at the beginning, it was a movement of morons. Of morons, yes, of social morons, of illiterates, of social illiterates. People couldn't read, couldn't write, couldn't say their prayers. What we call it in Yiddish, Yishuvnike, the people who live in the villages. The villages. It's a moral. I mean, actually, it was a funny movement, but this was great. But basically, even before Hasidism, there was a certain democracy, because a Jew, of course, we always spoke about the Jew. The Jew was to serve himself. Why should he universalize his ideals, although these ideals are universal, basically? The Jew felt everybody's a Jew. I mean, no way. Take even in Norway to clear him. Take even our arrangements in the synagogue. It was the most democratic arrangement in the synagogue. We have no clergy. That's why we have no clergy. The rabbi is a teacher. He's a servant of the community. He's not a clergyman in the sense of the Catholic priest. He has no specific metaphysical endowment. He's not invested with anything. He's just one of the crowd. He's more responsible for that, but certainly has no more privileges. And that's why we can double, we can pray, we can organize a service without the participation of the rabbi. But he cannot recite mass, the same mass, without the participation of the clergyman. This all I'm imposing, I mean, you see the whole Judaic structure. That's why we have no authority. That's why I'm opposed to the idea of Sanhedrin in Eretz. I'm deadly opposed to it. Perhaps Sanhedrin may serve a useful purpose now, particularly controlling the lunatic fringe within Orthodoxy. Yes, perhaps. But it means the establishment of authority, and there was complete freedom in the halacha.
But there always was an aristocracy within the synagogue, within the temple, among the...
What kind of aristocracy?
We sat in certain places.
You mean the Mizrach and Maror?
Yeah, you had a better place than you had a lower place.
That didn't mean much. And I tell you, listen, you were wasting also. I'm so quite a few things, you know. Huh? Yes, of course. I mean, now they want to see Hasidism, I mean, in terms of Marxist materialism, of historical materialism, and perhaps some elements of... We should not deny that this interpretation is completely false. I say that this interpretation is false. Perhaps there are a few more things correct. But you cannot... The whole Jewish society wasn't built. You don't have any aristocracy. I mean, aristocracy is abhorrent to the Jewish country. No.
Well, Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Yes, sir.
Well, if this is true, what is the difference in the concept of the so-called when you were asked a question about prayers, you talked about the fact that the prayers were standardized for the people who was an attempt to democratize religion.
Correct.
Well, doesn't this smack of a hierarchical kind of concept about man?
Hierarchical, he said.
Yes. In other words, some people, why should words be more meaningful as articulated by some people and more beautiful? You use the expression that these prayers were more beautiful. In the sight of God, why should they be more beautiful? One set of words is compared to another.
No, I didn't say that as God simply discriminated between the prayer which was recited with ease in a beautiful language, beautiful vernacular, and the prayer which, I mean, the one was, I mean, was incoherent. I didn't say that. All I said is that since religion must become institutionalized, we have to accommodate the illiterate as well. And to leave prayer to the individual, he should say what he feels, would be an ideal, and that effect would be an ideal. But if there are many people can't express themselves, and that's why they had to standardize prayer. I mean, that's what I said. But I didn't say that a man who offers, I mean, he offers a prayer, I mean, grammatically correct and so to say, and expressed in beautiful phrases, his prayer is more acceptable to God than the prayer of the illiterate. I didn't. Yes, I'll tell you, as far as prayer is concerned, I want to tell you something. There is a Sefer Hasidim, the book of Hasidim, but not this Hasidim. It means of the medieval Hasidim in Germany, about the 12th, 13th, 14th, 13th century. There is a funny incident related, that there was a shepherd near a community, near mine, and he was an illiterate, he couldn't pray. This story is already Hasidim also have this story, but this is an original story. He couldn't pray, so he used to say, but he was a shepherd, he used to take care of the flock, of sheep, goats particularly. Goats, I mean, the community never had, a Jew never in Middle Ages couldn't afford to buy a cow. Cow was, you know, a capitalist, but only goats, only actually goats. I mean, we know that from the response, so there is a goats and sheep. So he used to take care of the goats, the goat herd. So every morning he used to get up and say, my God, I love you so much. I am take care of the goats of the community, and I charge everybody, you know, 5 pennies, you know, 5 quarters, I mean, for a week. I can promise you, I'll take care of your goats, if you entrust me your goats, without any pay. This was his prayer. It's a historical incident. So this prayer, a strange prayer, a new literate primitive prayer. So one of the great scholars of the Balei HaTosafot of the Rashi school passed through this village, and overheard, and he was eavesdropping, and overheard him in this prayer. So he began to yell, it is blasphemy, what do you mean? You say to God, I mean, you think there are his goats, where God is. So he said, I cannot pray otherwise. He said, I'll teach you just one sentence, one word. And he taught him, Shema Yisrael, Adeshem Alekeinu, Adeshem Achad. You are Israel, God is our God is the one. It's not difficult to repeat. Well, apparently, mind was a bit stupid and being dull. He forgot. And one day he said it, the next day he forgot it. So then this scholar, who once dreamt, and said, you have committed a crime. And men prayed, and prayer was most acceptable to God. And by your intervention, you stopped him from praying, because you told me it's blasphemy, what he said. And the Shema Yisrael is quite forgotten, so he doesn't say anything. The contact with him and God had been interrupted, completely discontinued. Go, take a special place. So that's your lecture. Tell him to say the prayer, the old prayer. It's the best prayer. And he went to say it. This is a story. I mean, Hasidim also have this story. This shows you how Judaism has approached prayer. Of course, that's what I have against the modern temple and the modern synagogue. And I'm not discriminating between the Reform temple or the Orthodox synagogue. I don't care. They're both wrong in this regard. There is already a hierarchy. The rabbi is a part of the hierarchy. The president is a part of the hierarchy. The board of trustees is a part of the hierarchy. It sometimes it's repulsive. When you look on what's going on in Jewish temples or synagogues, I can't say it. Now let me continue for a moment. In view of the foregoing analysis, I'm going now to take up the problem. It is called, this problem is to me is significant, relevant, because perhaps I personally suffered a great deal from that. Let me be a bit... suffered a great deal from that, and it's also a problem of the Jew in general. It's a problem of loneliness. I personally suffer. Not as a Jew, as a prayer. And of course, and because, you know, I mean, experience is the mother of thought. Not need to experience the mother of invention, but experience is the mother of suffering, is the mother of thought. Thought, self-analysis, soul search. Perhaps whatever I'll say here is very subjective, profound, tough, like a confession, but I believe I have enough proof This was a Judaic approach. And basically, I was raised in a house, of Jewishness. So I've absorbed many things which are not, so to say, spelled out in books. We're trying to find out and spell out some intuition. In the view of the foregoing analysis, so please, if I am a bit subjective, so ignore me. But however, I mean, I believe that this is the only approach which a Jew can take for the problem of Jewish loneliness, which should not be overlooked by any Jew. And now I'm not taking sides. Nationalistic Jew, Jew who recommends assimilation as a solution to Jewish problem, a religious Jew, a secular Jew. I don't take sides. I detach myself from all ideologies. But I believe that the problem of loneliness is a common denominator in all Jews. Whether it's our fault or it's the fault of our neighbors, I don't know. I don't want to indict anybody. Many times I think our gentle friends are not to be blamed, perhaps it's our fault. But it affects. But I have to dwell at this problem at length. It's a psychological problem. It's depth psychology. And it's also a metaphysical problem. To me, any problem which is involved in depth psychology becomes a metaphysical problem. I believe that our experiences, our inner experiences, not the superficial experiences, the platitudinous experiences, but the intrinsic experiences, reflect metaphysical ideas. In view of the foregoing analysis, it means that I spoke about, again, numinous men for himself, and charismatic men who keep some, who passes on a message to others. It means he contributes to society, charisma men. In the view of the foregoing analysis, we may understand a little better the experience, I'll call it for time being, solitariness. I'll show you why I use this word. As a matter of fact, we may say that there are two basic feelings in man. One feeling is that of loneliness. The second feeling is that of aloneness. If you take the adverb alone and convert it into a noun, aloneness. And let me say, use an axiomatic formula, then I'll explain. Lonely is charismatic man. Means men in society is lonely. A man who wants to deliver a message is lonely. Alone is numinous man. Man for himself. The inner world in man. Adam, before Eve was created, I'm referring to the previous lectures, roving along the uncharted lanes of a dreary world of animal, plant, and mineral, there was no other being who was alone. He was lonely. Adam, in Eve's company, when he is unable to deliver the message of his experience to others, then he is lonely. In order to understand the difference between these two unique experiences, let us look at it from a different viewpoint, the pragmatic psychological. To be a lonely, to be alone is identical with being the only one. The only one. The Greek word of monos, one. The Hebrew yachid, not so much echad as yachid, would convey quite exactly the aloneness experience. It means not to be one, the only one. Loneliness is only possible among equals. When am I among people? When am I among people, I'm not alone. But I can be very miserably lonely. The peasant is not lonely among princes. But when he is excluded from his village community, then he becomes lonely. Nor would civilized man suffer from loneliness if he had to spend some time among Australian bushmen. or South Sea Islander. Only his expulsion from civilized society, in which he was born and reared, would hurt him deeply and evoke in him the feeling of loneliness. Aloneness means not finding anybody but me. To differ alone means to be different. And to be the only one, and I don't mean the gentleman, ladies and gentlemen, in egocentric sense. Please, I mean, of course, it can be infused with egocentrism, but I don't mean that way, any metaphysical level. The only one, to be oneself, is alone. If a man is oneself, is alone. In all the ramifications, aloneness is when man finds himself in all the ramifications of individuality and otherness and uniqueness. And this is exactly in which the inner worth of the personality is expressed upon a situation. To be alone denotes the singular personal aspect. A new dimension which every personality has, a new dimension which is incommensurate with the unique dimension of the other personality, a new dimension which renders the existential experience incommensurate. You have existential experience higher. You have a high awareness higher than high awareness. I have the consciousness of my existence, ego consciousness. Cannot compare them. Like a three-dimensional quantity with a two-dimensional one. They're not that incomplete. The numinous in a person, the mysterious in a person, the subject, which is not subject to charismatic externalization and objectification. This tells aloneness. Adam for himself, or Adam for other I, for myself is alone. Please don't interpret that in a natural meaning, in the meaning of egotism. Adam as a companion, who when he is eager to deliver his message to his fellow man, who is incapable of suppressing his life story, this is how a man begins to contribute to society. He cannot contain himself. He wants to pass on his message. Everybody has an interesting message for others. Whether it's a scientific message, or it's an ethical message, or it's an economic message, or it's a political message, everybody's contribution is a message. I mean, it's a kerygma. He's incapable of suppressing his life story and keeping it a secret. Then he becomes sometimes lonely. Sometimes, when life story is too powerful, it cannot be contained. It is too great an adventure not to be told. It's many times... It's many times, I mean, man feels alone and he wants to approach the vow to whom he tries to deliver the charisma, to relate his existential romance. Then, if he finds out that the vow doesn't care for his message, then I suddenly step out of my seclusion. I'm somehow not satisfied with myself. And I want to approach the vow. Establish contact liaison with the Tao. And I tell him, listen, I have a nice story to tell you. I mean, the story may be scientific invention or anything. A nice story. You'll be interested to hear this story. I mean, a great message. And the Tao turns around with scorn and disdain. Then Adam came to Eve, I don't know whether this transpired or not, apparently not, and said he wanted to deliver a message there, probably a message of love. And Eve turned around haughtily, said, I'm not interested in your feelings. Then Adam was not alone that time, because he was already in society. Then he felt alone. When society does not consider his message essential, in his contribution worthwhile, if his story is ridiculed, and his accomplishments rejected, then it feels he is not needed in society. Then he's off. If Eve rejects Adam, Friday afternoon, Friday morning, Adam was not lonely. So they had no need to communicate with anybody because there was nobody. But Friday afternoon, after he sprang into existence, and he wanted to communicate with her, to flirt with her, and if Eve rejects Adam, the lot of suffers from loneliness. From the R. It means, in other words, the solitary man, the man who is alone, can never be lonely. The lonely man is never alone. He is alone. Why is he not lonely? Because he's alone. Because there is no one else like him. Association, direct communal existence, communication of existence, does not fascinate him. He doesn't want to refuse to step out of himself to meet other fellows. His participation communalized is indirect, and that's why he's alone. Now let us see. What do you suffer from? From aloneness or loneliness? I'm not speaking now about the Jew, but about modern man. Loneliness and aloneness represent not only two disparate metaphysical ideas, it means numinous experience of Adam, and the charismatic experience of Adam, Adam for himself and Adam in company with Eve, are numen and charisma, but constitute two different experiences, even at the psychological level. Loneliness is a destructive emotion. That is destructive. I can tell you, you say in Hebrew, in Chacham Kepal, no one is as wise as a man of experience. I can tell you, loneliness is a destructive emotion. It scatters one's mind and expresses itself in morbidity, in simple morbidity, unnerving anxiety, in mental dreariness, and self-negation, which borders almost on self-suicidal tendencies. Aloneness, it is, if I may use the expression by Adler, it is a disjunctive emotion, loneliness. Basically, a destructive emotion. Aloneness, contrary to loneliness, is what Adler says. If I use this term, he doesn't speak about that. But the term is a conjunctive emotion. It's a creative emotion. Although not always a pleasant one. It first can be a great experience, but not a pleasant one. It sets all our aptitudes in motion, kindles the flames of rebellion against the trite and conventional, awakens the man his dormant talent, and calls for action. If a man understands the feeling of aloneness, how the body, feeling of aloneness can be transformed into egocentrism, which again is a disjunctive emotion, but there are limits on it. And Judaism was pretty aware of these fine boundary lines. Men, now let us come to men. Men is aware of both numinous and charismatic aspects. We said basically men can never be for himself completely, can never be in society completely. Correct? That's what we said before. He is numinous, he's rooted in himself, he can never rid himself of these roots. On the other hand, he's not satisfied with himself. He has to step out. Letove yota Adam levado. It's not good for men to be alone. And levado means they are not lonely, but alone. Esele ezachner, they all create a helper opposite him. There is a dialectical experience. He oscillates, he fluctuates between two poles, between two extremes. He is for himself and then in society, both. So man, when I said the lonely man is never alone, the man who is alone is never lonely, I spoke about ideal type. But concrete man, practical man, he's both. He can be alone, he also can experience loneliness. Man is aware of both the numinous and charismatic aspects. Within his personal existence, must experience aloneness as well as loneliness. He experienced aloneness as numinous, as mysterious presence for himself, he experienced loneliness in his search to other time, to other now. He must feel alone because solitary Adam in him, in every of us, there is a solitary Adam before the creation of his, does not care, nor is he able to communicate anything to others. He is silent, withdrawn into himself, lives in solitude, in hiding. He does not meet anybody who resembles him. He is the unique and the only one present, strange and one-timely. He is alone without friends and without tying himself or integrating himself into a community existence, into togetherness and existential fellowship. As I said, Judaism considered all our ties, social ties, as relative, because even marriage, no sacrament, can be divorced. For one reason, because only charismatic men can tie himself with women. Adam, from Friday morning, before Eve was created, did not enter the marriage union. And this is why husbands survived the death of their most beloved wife. Wife survived the death of their most beloved husband, regardless of the impact of the first shock. Now, yes, on the other hand, we must experience loneliness. Companionable Adam, not solitary Adam, wedded to Eve, living in comradeship with others, anxious to deliver his message, to reveal his inmost self, to communicate something of his personal, intimate, existential awareness to and live in communion with others, must at one time, and this experience must, everybody must go through this experience, must at one time or another find the ridicule or misunderstanding. His message not wanted, and his story rejected, and the greatest and the most. Even the great and mighty must reach the stage when they are not more needed, and hence looked upon with sympathetic disdain. The great scientist who has, for instance, revolutionized thinking and whose contribution to society was of enormous value, will finally discover that based on his very discoveries and ideas, other men, younger and more vigorous intellectually, since they did not have to struggle with the old and the obsolete as he did, and for whom he had paved the way, have advanced much farther than he. He must realize that he, the teacher of a whole generation, must listen carefully now, a time comes, to the opinions of his disciples, and that his message is no more relevant. If there was a man who experienced this, I can tell you, who was the greatest scientist of our generation, Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein's creativity ran dry. You know, there are well scientists know about it. And his own field, of a far me and his disciples and the young people, and worked with his own theories to such an extent that in his late years he didn't die old, with which he could not cope intellectually. And he was, I mean, people were close to him, told me, he was the most miserable person on earth. Of course, people paid tribute to him, lip service, the layman, but the scientist not interested in the tribute paid by the New York Times. It's not important to him. It's important, I know, even in the halacha, in Jewish scholarship, we are not interested in the crowd. We are interested in a few scholars. And the few scholars upon whom Einstein was interested, they knew that he is lonely, he cannot contribute anymore to society. The same was true of Kant, the great German philosopher Kant, revolutionized German philosophy. His own disciple Fichte wrote that he himself, Kant, doesn't understand the consequences or the conclusions to be drawn from the philosophy he developed. And the philosopher of the time agreed with Fichte, not with Kant. And this is true of the President of the United States when he leaves office. I believe that Eisenhower is beginning to have this feeling now. That's what I'm afraid. Not afraid, I wouldn't say afraid, but I understand this feeling. And this is everybody, a rabbi, and he gets old, or at least older, not a rabbi shouldn't get too old in order to be not wanted By society, if he crosses the threshold of faith, a phobia, I mean, he's already on the other side of the fence, and so forth on. We cannot escape from this experience, however excruciating it is. Loneliness is the twin feeling of disillusionment. This is the twin feeling of disillusionment. And Judaism said, I'll come later to it, anybody and everybody must be disillusioned once in his life, must be defeated. A man cannot be victorious. And if he is victorious continuously, so at least he is defeated in death. Of course.
Can't win.
Yeah, can't win. And but Judaism said that a man must be defeated, and our ways and means how men can mitigate his defeat. I'll come later to some of them. Must be defeated, not in death, but in lifetime. In his lifetime. This loneliness is a twin feeling of disillusionment. And since one must encounter frustration and defeat, he is ipso facto condemned to the agony of being rejected by society. Isn't an old father rejected by his own children? Even if they are good children, and that sent to his knees. I mean, I know that from my own experience. And anybody, there is no one who is. And even if his beloved wife, beloved husband, takes sick. And the doctor comes in and tells the wife that the ailment, the disease, it's fatal. Of course, the shock at the beginning, as a rabbi I happen to know, you certainly know, all the same problems. The shock is terrific. Men is shut up completely. The wife or the husband cannot imagine, cannot visualize a life without his beloved mate. I mean, how will he go on living? It's not something that the thread is, of life is torn, interrupted. Yes, correct. But he takes a little time, yes, and then he begins to readjust himself. And the beloved wife, the moment, still when the wife or the husband is still sick, still in the house, is looked upon, or he or she looks upon as a dead person, not belonging to the church or the family. And mentally, inwardly, this loving wife to the daughter husband, to the loving husband, the daughter wife, begins to readjust her or his life. I wouldn't say he or she is thinking of marriage already, but I don't know. I'm never sure about the human mind. I'm never sure about the human mind. I don't trust the human mind too much. And particularly, I've been Freud introduced this subconscious of what's going on there, no one knows. you see, and begin to readjust the furniture as a hostess, a very capable hostess, who decided to take on like a chair of the room, so already mentally begins to readjust, rearrange the furniture in the room. I mean, I would recommend you to read Tolstoy, Leon Tolstoy, his famous novel. It's not a novel, it's usually a short story, more or less. The Death of Ivan Ilyich, it is translated to English. The death, poor translation, The Death of Ivan Ilyich. And described there is actually a sick person who was dying. A George, with a family, his station in society. And little by little, loving, everything was loving. So, yeah, a warm atmosphere. But little by little, I see how the family is beginning to reconcile itself with the fact of his death. He noticed already the seamstress coming into the house. What does the seamstress do in his house? Her fair wife is already placed in order for mourning veil and a mourning garment. And if there is a picture of the loneliness of man, of the mighty man, in the Russian aristocratic society of old, in the last century, here it is in this Ivan Ilyich, lonely, who when he died, no one sympathized with him. I wanted to know, what is the name? No, just a moment. I wanted something else. What's his name? There is, the English writer, Wolf, yes? Tell us what is Luke Holm? Is there is how a brother or a sister dies. I didn't see the play, but I read a book. The sister died, and how after the sister died. I mean, they were mentally prepared for the death of the sister. How did he get so excited? Did he get drunk, I believe? If I'm not, or did he get intoxicated somehow? He did become hysterical because they are relieved at death. At one point, at one time or another, the living person becomes a load on the other. And death is a relief. I mean, it's involved in look home. It's a sweet angel.
Yes.
It's a brother. It's a brother. I don't remember. I read it about 10, 15 years ago. I didn't see it. It's his friend. You say, please, is it what kind of a brother?
First
brother. Right. It's his
friend. But a man who... anybody
see it?
The one? A man
who's
against the whole village, sir.
Mm. This is a different story. Different story. This is social revolt. Yes. You love it. Yes. But here is what Tolstoy wanted to bring out. I don't know whether Thomas Wolfe wanted to bring it out, but Tolstoy wanted to bring out the exact idea of defeat. Man is defeated. He's not only defeated in death, he's defeated before.
Well, that's what Wolfe in all his books, loneliness that you speak of.
Yes, with this type of loneliness, because, yes. But basically, loneliness is excruciating feelings, and it borders on the neurotic borderlines. But the question is how Judaism has tried to solve. Well, I can continue next.
Next week.
There is not another inner world, inward world, which is commensurate with mine. So far, he experiences both, but nevertheless, not old people experience a loneliness and aloneness equally. Some are so engrossed in their objectivating mission, in passing on their charisma, their message, in living for others, in externalizing themselves, that they simply have not time to dally in themselves, to exist for themselves. In a unique, unrepeatable manner, that the feeling of aloneness is almost alien to them. This mother man is so busy to somehow to make the other self, the Tao, understand him, to impress the Tao, to impose himself upon society. He's so busy doing all that, an externalization of his. And externalization means always universalization. It means also, standardization, to show that I am like others. I am a regular fellow, so to say. I am one of the crowd. That he forgets to live for himself. That finally, of course, the feeling of aloneness is almost alien to him. And if disappointment comes, and disappointment is bound to come, so he's a lonely being, not a being alone. He's a lonely being. There are always those people, and I'm speaking to you as a rabbi now, because this mental disposition is particularly very discernible among rabbis. I don't know other professions, but I know pretty well my profession. I mean, the people are engaged in my profession. They are always haunted by the malaise of modern society, perhaps by the fear we would not find recognition, by uncertain presentiments they will be not wanted. They are so busy, they are so preoccupied with this idea, to such an extent they forget the numinous facets of their own experience. We lack self-rootedness. Basically, Judaism spoke of men in terms of a tree. Ki Adam Itz HaSadeh. A man is like the tree in the field. What does it mean? And in the Bible, in particular in the Psalms, in Jeremiah, you'll find this metaphor. Man, tree. A very popular one employed by the prophet and the psalmist. What does the tree... First of all, tree means that man is an organic creature. An organic being, but more, man must be rooted. Tree is rooted in soil. Man is also rooted. Where is he rooted?
Of course, the final place where man strikes roots is infinity. But Judaism was not metaphysically orientated. Judaism was very realistic. So before man strikes roots in infinity, he should also find himself rooted in finitude. Where is the finitude? He can strike roots. Where? In himself. In himself. In his deep personality. In the deep recesses of his consciousness. And many people lack rootedness completely. And of course, if they lack rootedness, they have no self-experience. They have experience of many things. Their minds are sharp. Their vocabulary is rich. I mean, they are the sense of esprit is very developed in them. They are cultured, educated. They are excellent technicians. But they experience the outside world. They don't experience themselves. And this is basically for Judaism. This is the, so to say, the termination of the religious experience. Self-experience. They identify themselves with their objectivated or objectified reflection. They identify themselves with the reflection they see in the mirror. And of course, this mirror is society, the Tao, the other fellow, what he thinks of me. Not what I am, but how I impress others. This is the I. With their public picture, without knowing that there is a private world of their own. And the public picture is never commensurate with the private world. And usually, the private world is much richer and more comely and lovely and more graceful than their public world. Of course, these people are susceptible, very susceptible to public criticism and indifference. A remark by the Tao about their abilities or talents may shatter their existence, may bring the people to almost may bring on despair and hopelessness. And their loneliness experiences, if they experience loneliness, this loneliness experiences, if and when they cease to fascinate others, are a real torture. Everything in them is bolstered by external authority. They need authority to bolster their assurance. Their philosophy is built on expediency. Their reactions are eclectic, not original. And they try to enhance their shattered personality by leaning on others. When these others thrust them off, there is nothing left for them but despair and defeat. But it's a bitter defeat. They resemble the old wife of an Oriental potentate who gave everything she had, beauty, devotion, love to her master, and who discarded her for the sake of a younger girl. If you'll take the Bible, I always like to quote the Bible, what did the concubines mean to Ahasuerus of Persia after he married Esther? Because this person is a shifting personality, and a shifting personality is the loneliest being on earth. And a shifting personality cannot be a good Jew. Not a good man, and certainly not a good Jew. It's out completely. We rabbis, let me say this as a confession, I mean, we rabbis are very bad in this regard. We try to be everything under the sun, but not ourselves. We try to be orators, promoters, even social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, play the role of scholars, of publicists, of journalists, of authors. It's very nice. But in the first line, we must be ourselves, be a rabbi. We have no confidence in ourselves. We lack our self-experience as a rabbi. And that's why, I mean, in the rabbinic profession, many times fails, not because the people are not sincere. No. Not the rabbis fail, not because they're insincere. I know many rabbis are very sincere and very devoted and have a sense of commitment. Simply, they are not rabbis because they are not themselves. They are trying to imitate someone, to find grace with society, to get approval of society. And one is effed out for approval, for applause, cannot be a rabbi. He can be an artist, perhaps, on the stage, a movie actor, but not a rabbi. This is the main trouble with American rabbinate. When I speak of American rabbinate, I mean all shades included. The Orthodox rabbinate, conservative, reform rabbinate. We are everything under the sun but ourselves. This is reflected in our language, this is reflected in our sermons, this is reflected in our articles, this is reflected in our approach to life. We do many jobs and badly. Because we cannot attend to the many needs of the person. If there is social need, there is a social worker. If there is mental distress, there is a psychiatrist. The rabbi has to deal with one aspect of the personality, and this aspect is completely misunderstood by the rabbi for a certain reason, because he's not himself. This example, of course, applies to other professions as well. I cannot talk about other professions. But the rabbinic profession is certainly is affected by it. On the other hand, gentlemen, there are persons who, despite their commitment to the outside world, many a time bordering on the sacrificial, I want you to know. To be oneself does not mean to work, does not mean the egotism under the circumstances. Many persons, despite their commitment to the outside world, many a time bordering on the sacrificial, never forget their own private world. What I call it the charisma, the specific endowment of uniqueness and solitude, the numinous, the mysterious, that can never be thrust outside of the eye. Their charisma, their message, is fashioned not after the demands of society, but after an inner urge flowing from the mysterious and unknowable source. The story they tell, although somehow objectified and universalized to the medium of the abstract language of the logos, has not rid itself of the paradoxical and singular. On the contrary, their message is strange. There is originality. You find people, when they say a sentence, one single sentence, there is nothing exciting about the sentence, but the syntax of the sentence reflects originality. And you have people who have a beautiful vocabulary, almost unlimited, and they use the most beautiful word, but you'll take a look at the structure of the sentence, of one sentence, you'll find just commonness and reflection. Copy and what I call it mental plagiarism. Thank you. On the contrary, we find people, on the contrary, their message is strange, peculiar. Even the lingual symbols used by them in their dialogues and monologues are different from the vernacular. They betray original creative powers. There are no cliches in the language, no phrases, no flowers. I mean, it is simple, straight, but there is some, you'll find between the lines, the fingerprint of a unique personality. The charisma is not syncretic, nor eclectic, not just collective. See, I have impression when I read sometimes the sermon of a rabbi, that he collected just sentences from many books. That's my impression. I don't know whether I'm wrong or right, but this is my impression. Apparently his mind is eclectic. Is it just this storehouse, I mean? Where he opens probably one compartment and finds phrases. The phrases don't have to represent thought. The phrase is the purpose for itself. Because the man who has, so to say, who does not experience himself, his uniqueness, his numinous character, of course, basically operates with phrases, not with ideas. They, on the contrary, the numinous person, does not plagiarize nor copy popular slogans, nor does it attempt to serve the existent and the accepted. The numinous eye, with all its vigor and strangeness, although remote and uncommunicative, inspires indirectly whatever the numinous eye in them inspires, whatever they do, their sermon, their speech, their writings, their activities. The charismatic Adam betrays to some extent the secret of the numinous solitary Adam. Always dark, always for themselves, even when they preach at market squares and at the corner of busy streets, the numinous eye remains for himself. These people know, of course, of loneliness when their message is scoffed and disdainfully condemned, yet their loneliness is caused not by a capricious crowd, which the individual tried to please at the highest cost of losing his own self. But their message is scoffed when it is scoffed at, because their message is too unique, very independent. Charts, it is scoffed at because the one who delivers the message lives for himself even when he attempts to establish communication with others. At the root of this feeling lies the great experience of aloneness. If I should try to coin a name for this feeling of aloneness, I would call it the prophetic loneliness. It would be an equation between prophetic loneliness and aloneness. Prophetic loneliness is not the loneliness of the person, as I said, of the concubine who was, thrown away by the Oriental tyrant of Potentate, by Ahasuerus. It's prophetic loneliness. The isolation of Abraham carrying the message of the unknowable, invisible God. The isolation, the aloneness of Abraham, not condoning social evil and demanding the eradication of entrenched wrong. The solitude of Moses, following the episode with the golden calf, when he took his tent and pitched it without the camp, afar off from the camp. You have a Bible? This is not the ordinary feeling of loneliness. If you open just the Bible, it is Exodus 33. I mentioned it. Will Exodus 33, verse 7. And took the tabernacle and pitched it without the camp, afar off from the camp, and called it the tabernacle of the congregation. And it came to pass that everyone which sought the Lord went out unto the tabernacle of the congregation which was without the camp. It's aloneness, not loneliness. Not the crowd rejected Moses. Moses retreats from time to time from the crowd. It's a big difference. And it's interesting. And it came to pass when Moses went out unto the tabernacle that all the people rose up. He was respected by the crowd, admired by the crowd, although misunderstood by the crowd. And stood every man at his tent door and looked after Moses until he was gone into the tabernacle. And it came to pass, as Moses entered into the tabernacle, the cloudy pillar descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle in complete isolation, complete aloneness. The cloud separated between him and the people. And the Lord talked with Moses, of course. If one is alone, the Lord talks with him. If he is lonely, the Satan ridicules him. Now the Lord talks with him. And so this is the difference. Or, for instance, the aloneness of an Elijah who fled to the Horeb Mount, who was summoned by God to come outside the cave and answer a few questions. If you just be so kind, can you take Kings 1? Imagine it. Kings 1. Or Kings 2? Kings 1. Yes, Kings 1. Just a minute. Yes. Kings 1. Kings 1, chapter 19. And verse 9. Kings 1, chapter 19, verse 9. And he came thither unto a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said unto him, what dost thou here, Elijah? It means, why did you retreat in a cave? Why don't you mingle with the crowd? You are a prophet. And he said, and Elijah answered, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of the hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I only am left, levadi, alone. And they seek my life to take it away. Again, expression of loneliness. The prophet Moses, the aloneness was due to the fact there was no liaison between Moses and the people. Moses was disappointed. Moses towered above the people. The people couldn't understand him. Moses felt that from time to time he should retreat from the camp into himself. And the pillar of the cloud separated him from the people. In Elijah, the story is a little different. He was persecuted because he was the champion of truth, the champion of the God of Israel, the champion of justice. He fought against all these heathen corruption, pagan habit, and idolatrous cults. He was persecuted. He fled. Moses didn't flee. Elijah fled. But not the lonely person who is in despair, but the person who is alone, he is proud of his aloneness. The prophet is not lonely, is rather alone. To be alone, as I have stressed before, is identical with being the only one. The Greek monos, the Latin salus, the Hebrew yachid, would convey the aloneness experience. Elijah said that he was a lonely prophet, but that was he did not say that he was a lonely prophet, but that he was the only prophet, levadi. Short and elaborate. Prophetic, if you ask me, and all prophets were lonely. Why? You'll find the description of Jeremiah, Isaiah, I mean, Ezra, all of them, there is a certain air of loneliness, I mean, a certain sense of loneliness hovering in the air. Why were they lonely? In the sense, I mean, rather alone. Why? Because prophetic loneliness or aloneness is a result of charismatic incongruity, of prophetic strangeness, of an existence which is desecrated to something. The existence of the crowd is a non-desecrated existence, basically. It was true in olden times, it is still true today. The crowd is not desecrated. It is an existence with commitments to a singular goal. It's a result of an ideal which is unique, and a result of an outlook which is strange. The human being is alone when he cannot exercise his powers to engage in conversation, to impart his aspirations, longings, and visions to the crowd, because the receptive capacity is either limited or the crowd does not understand. He tries to give of himself, to teach, to exhort, to guide. He wants to share his existential experience with others, to join up with his fellow man. But all his efforts are rejected, since he is misunderstood. While at the first level of loneliness about mother man, the individual becomes useless to the crowd, because his creativity and ingenuity have dried up, have run dry. At the prophetic plane, the aloneness is not the result of, so to say, of sterility. On the contrary, the giver abounds in all these talents. There is no recipient. The recipient is absent. Either he is incapable of or unwilling to grasp the prophetic message which refutes traditions, invalidates accepted standards, and revolutionizes, I mean, truisms and commonplaces and philosophical outlooks, thinking and action. God is alone, but he is not lonely. The prophet is alone, but he is not miserably lonely. And let there be no mistake. Prophetic solitude is a very painful and tormenting experience. Yet, it is frequently a stimulating experience as well, and which drives men to creativity, to carry on. While loneliness in the general sense paralyzes or immobilizes all capabilities, all talents, or attitudes in man. And I want you to understand, when I speak about a prophet, I must say the prophet may be a very useful man. Doesn't mean a man who doesn't participate in society. He may be involved in the cooperative effort of society. He may participate in the reciprocal arrangements which are responsible for the flow of goods and exchange of services within a respective community. He's not a hermit. I'm not speaking about a hermitage. Yet this fervent activity in the realm of the utilitarian order of things does not dispel the tragic being alone experience. He belongs to society, at the same time finds himself at an endless distance away from it, alien and strange. to his friends and acquaintances. He belongs, cooperates, meets them every day. He's a very productive person. He's not a schlemiel. He's not a misfit in the society. He's not crazy. It's not madness on the part. He is active in society. He can contribute the most, I mean, greatly to our the general welfare. But still, he doesn't submerge in society. He has a world for himself. The life story of Abraham or the other patriot or even Moses or Elijah picture this paradoxical ambivalence. Abraham negotiates with the Hittites, purchases land from them, concludes treaties with kings and princes. His mannerism does not differ from theirs. His routine is the same. And yet, reading the story of Abraham, he's the same person, the same Hittite, the same Jew, the same member of the Canaanite society. Yes. His speech, his dress, his manners, his habits are fitting. He also observes the etiquette, the general rules of etiquette, of courtesy and politeness, and talks like one of them. And still, between the lines, you feel Abraham is different. He's unique. He's not like Ephron the Hittite, or Avi Meller, the king of the Philistines, or like Pharaoh, the king of the Egyptians. He's different. It's hard sometimes to define in what respect is different. What is exactly this mark of distinction? Is a figure who towers above them, but not so much above them, as a figure who is both at the same time. He is within society and at an endless distance from society. This is Abraham, and this is also Moses, and this is also Elijah. You see, our picture of the prophet is not commensurate with the picture of the saint in the gospel. It's not the father of the desert. The fathers of the desert simply condemn society. Because society stands for a sinful order of things. They condemned, they simply said goodbye and retreated into the cave. Into the caves or into the desert. They were, as far as the fathers of the desert are concerned, and they are the fathers of the church, of the Christian church, we may say they simply cultivated either odium sepuli, hatred of the interim period, because the Christianity history is just an interim period between two arrivals of Christ. The historical arrival which took place 1900 and so many years ago, and the second arrival of Christ, when he'll sit in judgment over the world. What happens between is nothing but a between, just an interim period. So it means this means secular, and that's where you say secular. When we use the word secular, it doesn't mean mundane. It means more interim. But it is interim. It means it is like we call twilight, the Hebrew word binash mashot, twilight. It's neither day nor night. So you have to live, of course, in the interim. And many generations kept on living, dying in the interim, and Christ hasn't come yet. But it is odium sepuli means I hate it, because it's no existence. Existence is corrupt, sordid, has no meaning, meaningless, insensate, paradoxical. Odium. It's sinful, yes. Odium sacrally. At best you can say they didn't cultivate odium sacrally, at least contempt to sacrally. They had contempt for it. I wouldn't say they hated it, they had contempt for it. Nothing of that sort can you find among the Jewish prophets. Neither odium sacrally nor contempt to sacrally. There was neither hate nor contempt for this world, because the prophets fought for this world. They fought for this world, for this social order. They wanted to change it, they wanted to reform it, they wanted to rehabilitate men, they wanted to raise men to a higher level. But man is good, basically. At least he has potentialities, great potentialities, at least. so it's not the aloneness of the father of the desert, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. It is the aloneness of a father who does not find contact with his son. Many times, fathers don't find contact with their sons. They can't communicate the right ideas to their sons. I mean, it's not a curse of, I mean, an old curse. It's very modern. I mean, sometimes we feel there is a gap between ourselves and our sons and our daughters. Would you say there is odium or contemptus? No. Our love for them is not affected, but still we are at a certain distance from them. It's exactly the relationship of the prophet to the world, to society. He loves society, he sacrifices himself for society, he gives everything he has to society. Everything he has. And the preachers, actually, I mean, the preachers' ideals for society, for this interim society, for the secular, not for world to come, for this interim period. But on the other hand, he finds himself at a distance. And is one of them, and nevertheless, a mysterious and unknown figure. Perhaps, I would say, the two introductory words that were uttered by Abraham in his speech, in his addressing himself to the Hittites, reflect this dichotomy. If you'll take the Genesis, just a moment, I'll tell you where it is. It's interesting. Genesis, Chayesoro, yes. Chayesoro, Genesis, it is 23, verse 3. Verses 3 and 4, very interesting. And Abraham 19, Genesis 23, excuse me, comma 3, 4. And Abraham stood up from before his dead, when Sarah died, and spake unto the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger, it's interesting, and a sojourner with you. And the translation is not correct. It's, I am a stranger and an old resident. In your land, both. A stranger and an old resident. Sojourner is little, has again this, I would say, this meaning of it, semantically means more temporary, or temporary state. But Teshuv means an old-timer. I am a stranger and an old-timer. It's a funny introduction. He's either a stranger, an immigrant, a newcomer, or he's an old-timer, a citizen. How can one hold both, the status of a citizen, and also at the same time the status of a stranger, of an alien? But Abram told the Hittites, I am both. I am alien, and also to you, and also a friend of yours, an acquaintance of yours. It's very strange. This is exactly what he said, reflected his charismatic man in society, he was a member of their society for. A numinous man, he was for himself. In particular, with the prophet, his inner world was so apart from their world that he was a stranger. On the contrary, the way he expressed himself, he acted, his mannerism, his speech, his dress, his knowledge, his background, they were identical. Is the externals which were cultivated by the Hittites. Now let me see, it's very important for our problem, for our Jewish problem. And I'll tell you, I'm trying, as I told you, I'm not preaching here, but I'm beginning to tread on dangerous ground, you see. Up to here, you see, I've explored areas in which there is no disagreement. As far as Jewish social ethics is concerned, we are all unanimous. Not even the non-Jews are. There is unanimity even among Jews and the better non-Jews, the real scholars. What Jewish social ethics means and the great contribution it made toward the understanding of man and his death. But here I'm venturing a little bit in a parochial realm. So, I'm not preaching, I told you before, I'm sharing my own experience with you. It was both a personal experience for me as a person, as an individual, and also as a Jew. Because my life story is one of the wandering Jew I mean. I've been in so many lands, and I had to establish contact with so many cultures and languages that simply I had to come to grips, I mean, with this problem of loneliness and aloneness, and I had to solve it. Otherwise, I thought, I mean, when I found that I was ready to commit suicide, as I told you last time. So all I say is I'm sharing my experience, as I understand myself as a Jew and as a man. I want to say something else. Loneliness and aloneness represent or symbolize two aspects in man. Fate manifests itself in loneliness. Destiny in aloneness. What's the difference between fate and destiny? What's the difference between fate and destiny, ladies and gentlemen? If there is no difference, of course we use it. I mean, in our colloquial, we substitute fate for destiny and destiny for fate. I mean, but I don't believe that they are both equivalent at the level of semantics. If you analyze the words properly, in Hebrew, the words are more beautiful. Fate is goral. It's even Yiddish too, geral. Goral. It's like throwing lots, you see. Goral. And I draw lots out of a basket. And destiny, there is a modern word for it, a beautiful word. Yehud. Yehud, something prepared. Yehud. Yud, ayin, vav, dalet. Yehud. Yud, ayin, vav, dalet. It means, yoid means to prepare, to commit, to obligate, to accept, or to designate. Fate, geirol, denotes, if you'll ask me what I understand by fate, and what a Jew should understand by fate, denotes what the famous German existentialist, I mean, before the Second World War, who later turned a Nazi, famous Martin Heidegger, was a monk. I studied under him. He was a monk. And calls the state of being thrust in. A man is always in a state of being, he called it in German, hineingeworfen, being thrust in, or cast in, or thrown in. Where? Where is man cast in? Where? In an order which is neither sympathetic, nor even too, nor even tolerant of one's questing for meaningfulness and greatness. Man somehow is taken by his lapel and thrown into a world which he did not choose, certainly not, he was not consulted before he was born, and into an order of things and events, mechanical order of things and events, which has neither sympathy nor understanding for man and his needs. Fate denotes the tragic conflict between two orders, the meaningful and the nonsensical. Because nature around ourselves is nonsensical, simply nonsensical. There is no purpose, there is nothing. It's a mechanical occurrence, nothing else. Guided by the laws of physics, mathematical formulas, which don't make any sense, basically. Yeah. Law of gravitation, does gravitation make sense? Doesn't make any sense. There's no purpose to it, there's no telos to it, there's nothing. It's a law, it's a mathematical law. Yes. There are no values in this order, no values. And man cannot live without values, without ideals. And there's always a clash between the insensate or absurd order, mechanical order, and the axiological, I mean values, axiological order which man pursues and which man wants to attain. It is the conflict between the teleological order, set by a free creative personality and a mechanical order of the cosmic appearance. This is fate. What is destiny? What is destiny? Of course, destiny denotes also the state of being cast in. Because you cannot speak of human destiny unless you say that destiny represents also this tragic, so to say, experience, a man feeling that he didn't choose the life, I mean, he is living, but it was foisted upon him, imposed upon him, and he was thrown in into a certain environment, and the environment determined everything he is and everything he stands for. I mean, as to the first, so to say, is the point of departure, fate and destiny are identical. Also, destiny also denotes the state of being cast in into an unfriendly world, the clash between spirit and matter, between man and nature, between machine and telos, between fullness, meaningfulness, and emptiness, between a blooming garden and a desert. Also, but the point of departure is the same. However, fate and destiny differ not as to the point of departure, but as to the problem, what should men do with it? This is exactly the existentialist problem. They don't give an answer properly. What should men do with it? True, he was thrown in. He was cast in into an unfriendly world. There isn't much. To speak of freedom of will is a very precarious job. So shall I give up or shall I carry on? Shall men become, as theologians say, and they say it beautifully, shall human existence become a factum, a fact only? Or it should become an actus, an act, a creative act. This is here the problem. While fate, they give fate and destiny, give two solutions to this problem. While fate denotes the tragic sequel to that epic struggle, the defeat of men by absurdity and nonsense, destiny closes the chapter with a great finale. With men's not complete victory, as I said before, there is no complete victory, at least partial victory. Fate is reflected, you'll ask me, for two metaphors in the Bible, where one event reflected fate, hopelessness of man, complete defeat, crushing defeat, and another event which reflected men's destiny, men's ability to tower up.